Well, here we are, 1 o'clock. Well, not 1 o'clock. Okay, 5 after 1. Who's counting? I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. This is News Dissector Radio, heard every week at this time, around this time, sometimes at this time, on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. You can call in at 888-874-4888. That number again, 888-874-4888. 4888. Cat Waters is with us in the studio. George Martinez, the Occupy activist turned professor turned political candidate, couldn't make it, stuck in traffic. I don't know what happened to George. I hope he's okay, but he will be joining us on the phone. So we'll be talking with him in a moment or two about, is this a new strategy from Occupy to actually get involved in politics, you know, after denouncing politics for all this time, and the moribund, paralyzed, stalemated, dysfunctional, political system. Now, is Occupy going to get involved in it and try to take it over or have a voice in it? That's what we're going to try to find out in a minute or two. Coming up on the second half hour today, Leo Haviland. Leo Haviland is also on Wall Street, but he's not occupying. He's worked there. He's worked at Goldman Sachs. He spent 3 decades of experience in the Wall Street trading environment. He has had a research and sales career in stock, interest rate, foreign exchange, and commodities. However, he's written a really brilliant, interesting, fascinating book from the inside called Words on the Street, Language and the American Dream on Wall Street. Leo is going to say a few words, is going to join us and take your calls at the half hour at 1:30. So please stay tuned for this. It should be fascinating. The book itself is almost telephone book size, but quite brilliant. Kat?
Yeah, don't forget to tell the audience that you're on for 2 hours this week.
No, I'm not on for 2 hours this week. I'm only on for 1 hour. We are pre-recording an hour, which will be heard in the future sometime. So, but I will be doing a second show if I have the energy after this one. We'll see what happens. In the meantime, as we meet today, we're in a situation where, you know, in Syria, war continues. There's fear of a civil war erupting there. A new study found that the Supreme Court of this country has hit a new low in polling with the American people, just 44% supporting it. Of course, we had the events in Wisconsin this week, and we'll be talking about them as well. Locally, not far from where we are right now, 3 were found dead near Columbia University in a car parked near the campus at Columbia. I don't know much more about that, but we'll try to tell you a little bit more about that later. So stay with us here. News Dissector Radio, Progressive Radio Network. This is an extension of my blog at newsdissector.net. Check it out.
Something's wrong! Something's wrong!
There are only 5 countries in the entire planet that are more unequal than the United States in the distribution of our wealth.
This is corrupt!
Bankers, corporations throw the country into the gutter like dice. Whatever comes up, they win. Politicians are paid off to keep the game running. There's just no way you're going to be competitive in a rigged game.
It's just corrupt.
Some of the best people we have will never get a shot.
It's
something is happening in America. It's a movement moment. It's always a movement moment on this program, News Dissector Radio. And we are happy to be joined this morning, this afternoon, whatever time it is. It doesn't seem to matter. Here on Progressive Radio Network by George Martinez. George, an Occupy activist. He's in a professor. He's a thinker. He's an activist. He's been involved in Occupy the Hood, I believe, and helping to bring the message of Occupy into the boroughs, into other communities. And now he's announced for office. Good morning. Good afternoon. Good day, George.
Hi, Danny. Thank you for having me. Sorry I couldn't get there in person. Lots of traffic in New York City and lots of heavy campaigning this morning out in the district.
What are we going to do about this traffic, George? We've got to do something about it. No, let's not discuss that. I don't think you can. I don't think you can do anything about it.
Well, you know, as part of a new strategy for national investment in the public transportation and moving our cars, moving away to sustainable energy, I think it's something that we actually can start talking about.
Now, I know that listeners here on PRN have heard you, that there is a program that you're part of that's on the air here. But let's figure that maybe there's a new audience or a different audience listening here. And tell us a little bit about yourself and your background, what got you involved in Occupy. I know you're also a hip-hop artist and writer, so tell me about that as well.
Absolutely. Well, I'm born and raised in New York City, child of a single mama. First person in my family to graduate high school, and I was taught two things growing up. Never forget who you are, where you come from. Bring your experiences that you acquire in all walks of life to bear on solving problems. And I've committed my life to doing that as an organizer, as an activist, founder of the Blackout Arts Collective in the 90s, co-founder of the Hip Hop Association, currently the founder of the Global Block Foundation. And working through the nonprofit organizing and community has been critical to my life. I am a professor of political science, and I'm also a cultural ambassador, a hip-hop ambassador for the United States of America for the State Department. And, you know, I coming to my city early on, the second week of Occupy when it started. Something was going on in the city. We didn't know what exactly was going on. Some of the folks from my neighborhood had started hearing about it, so we showed up. And we showed up, and we kept showing up, and we kept finding people who were serious about raising awareness of the common issues that are affecting our country, particularly getting the corporate money out of our electoral process and the corrosive influence of that money over public policy. So I had a chance to, in the second week of the Occupy, to create a music video with my wife called Occupation Freedom, which became known as the official Occupy Wall Street hip-hop anthem. And as a member of Occupy the Hood, which does have a radio show on this network, been able to help capacity build, bringing the 20 years of organizing and nonprofit experience to bear on helping the capacity build through Occupy the Hood, through local Occupy chapters, and as Occupy musicians, because it's important that we're raising awareness and building solidarity with every tactic and every skill set that we have. And now, you know, part of my background is teaching political literacy, and quite frankly, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I don't want folks to just think that we the best that we have to do is just to be able to petition our government for redress of our grievances, which we are clearly doing as
so
part of the diversity.
Let me hop in here for a minute, George, because I hear your rap. I'm sympathetic to it. I'm also a New York City, native. I went to DeWitt Clinton High School in the Bronx. I was part of the movement. Those words, sick and tired of being sick and tired, really resonate with me because they were said by Fannie Lou Hamer at the height of the civil rights movement, and that's a tradition and a legacy that we need to carry on. Of course, the Mississippi Freedom Movement, which started as a protest movement, a get-out-the-vote, register-to-vote movement, also created a political party, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which I was honored to be part of. And now you are running for Congress. This is a new development, at least as far as Occupy people seem to be concerned.
That's right.
I've heard about one other person, but tell us about this. Why are you running for Congress, and what do you think is going to happen here? And speaking of money, you know, we just saw what happened in Wisconsin. The right wing, you know, organized and raised seven times as much as the unions and the progressive community there, and it seemed to have made a difference in the end.
Right. Well, one of the things we realize is from the Occupy Center, the core of the Occupy movement, the premise is to build autonomous grassroots community structures that can help neighborhoods start deliberating their own issues, start solving their own problems, and reducing our reliance on government in the first place. And that's an occupied value. But at the same time, we are raising awareness of the corrosive influence of the corporate money in our political processes, and we have nonviolent legal remedies to not only raise awareness, but to actually start to target and remove all politicians who are complicit with taking corporate money and not allowing the people to control our democratic institutions. So as a part of the diversity of tactics, Bum Rush the Vote, which is the name of our electoral direct action, because we're calling it an electoral direct action because it's coming from the space of Occupy, saying that when issue literacy is brought to bear with direct action, we can do more than just affect the conversation. We can absolutely influence outcomes of elections, which fundamentally means starting to control offices, keeping them tethered to the people, direct democracy, and having that mechanism be able to protect the interests of a community when often corporations would do things a little differently.
Kat wants to hop in here.
From that perspective.
George, she has a question
for George,
you.
I met you at, I think it was a Floridation rally at City Hall, and I got your card.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask you, are you familiar with the Occupy Wall Street working group, Get Money Out of Politics? We would love for you to join us every Wednesday at 7 at 60 Wall Street because, I mean, there's actually two meetings. There's a meeting before that at 5:30, you know, to end corporate personhood. And like, they're all sort of related. And, I mean, you know, so like there's a lot of people that are actually, you know, think that subject, you know, needs to be focused on.
George, you know, I was at a dinner the other day with Bill Clinton spoke at it. Okay.
All right.
What I was surprised about was Bill Clinton was extremely critical of the dysfunctional political stalemate in Washington. He didn't have one good thing to say about the electoral system. He was talking about NGOs, you know, people who are building partnerships and networking and creating, you know, organizing new people into politics as being the future of politics.
Right.
Now, he then went and said, keep the taxes that Bush, tax breaks that Bush passed in place. Then he reversed himself and now is against that. But the fact is that major politicians, a former president, seems to be, you know, totally exasperated, frustrated with the political system the way it is. And so my question to you is, let's say you win, you run, and you win. You're going to have a hell of an uphill battle, friend.
Yes. No, well, this is part of why what we're doing is beyond a one candidacy deal. This is part of the movement. This is part of a diversity of tactic and a new strategy of affecting outcomes in the electoral arena, which means we're building a campaign that's a do-it-yourself democracy model. It's open source. It's crowdfunded. And our intention is to share what we learn doing this as an inaugural candidacy. And of course, I'm a well-qualified candidate, but as an inaugural direct action, we intend to be able to breed other electoral actions in the city and across the country. And quite frankly, my agenda is to be able to pull back the House of Representatives with an unwavering progressive front across the country in 2 years to be able to deliver on the promises that Americans want to see. And the fundamental core issue is who owns our democratic elections. Is it the people who have the constitutional right and obligation, or is it the corporate personhood, the corporate persons who use their money to influence the outcomes of policy, and they're not people. Corporations are not people.
That's right.
Money is not speech. I am associated with the affinity group or the work groups that you did mention, and associated with the affinity group of the end corporatism group.
What kind of feedback are you getting from other people in Occupy? You know, there's a tremendous fear among some in Occupy, you know, Adbusters and others, you know, about co-optation. Somehow, if you are interacting with people who are not like you, you're going to be co-opted by money and the rest. I don't believe in that. I don't think that's true. I think they'll be co-opted by you. Personally, I think that, you know, that the chances that, you know, people are so desperate for new ideas that they're open, you know, would be open to an articulate presence like yourself and others who are raising these issues. But, you know, there is a sort of, you know, suspicion, if you will, in Occupy about having anything to do with, quote, the system.
I think that the suspicion is bigger than just Occupy, and people are appropriately skeptical of engaging a broken system. There's no question about that. The system is broken, and we should be skeptical of our engagement in it. But when a movement is coming on all fronts, no stone will be left unturned. And so the reality is that we must engage in all spaces, especially when consider we occupy the SEC. We occupy the board of directors. We occupy the New York City, the Department of Education, and the panel on education policy. But I know that we can begin to replace those appointed people who make education policy. What I know is that in New York City, we can organize, and we don't have to talk about ending stop and frisk. We can stop it when we actually are able to control the political apparatus, the mayor's office, the city council that lead the policy of the NYPD. So as part of our strategy is absolutely, well, I'm not encouraging that people choose one or the other. We are encouraging that everyone get in where they fit in, that the tapestry of organizing and activism will make a difference on moving agenda forward, that some of us will engage the electoral process directly head on with the values of the movement, building a people's machine to compete with the corporate machines, while the rest of us at the same time are raising awareness and building horizontally in the neighborhoods.
I like that.
To empower people.
I like that, George. Get in where you fit in. You know, I just wanted to report, if you don't know this, it's in my blog at newsdissector.net today, but the judge in New York, federal judge Rakoff, has now said that the lawsuit against the NYPD in connection with the Brooklyn Bridge arrests can be pursued and can continue. So
right.
It's a class action lawsuit, and it's a way of fighting back against,
exactly.
The unconstitutional illegal, you know, arrests by the NYPD. And here's another example of Occupy moving into institutional spaces,
exactly.
and taking action. I think it's important to note this because, you know, there's a whole flurry of articles coming out, Forbes magazine, you know, there are no new ideas and Occupy, it's over.
Yeah.
You know, Huffington Post, it's kind of over. One of their columnists saying, certainly even Adbusters, you know, they're selling out, you know, our values. It's must be nice to sit up in Canada and to give orders
right.
to people
right.
in New York. But, you know, nevertheless, there's a lot of, you know, kind of a way in which a lot of people who, you know, the great minds here, are basically ready to write Occupy off, and you are challenging that by actually moving on the offensive and taking new actions.
What I know is that people who are engaged every day in community building, who are excited, who are inspired by the assembly in Liberty Square, have not stopped working. What I know is that New York City had a May Day to remember, a May Day that we haven't seen the likes of which for a very long time, with 40,000-plus people were out here. People are still organizing locally. We're organizing in other ways. And the part of the issue that I reject with the call that something is dead or something is dying is we organized around an idea. And the idea is that we must stop the corporate control over our democracy. And I think that's universal. Now, there's social issues, other issues have come to bear, but that issue hasn't died. That issue is front and center. Wisconsin shows us that we're right on target. It shows us that we have much more work to do, and I know that people are organizing in lots of different ways and spaces, and I reject the call from anyone in this leaderless movement to say what it is today, what it's going to be tomorrow. We make it happen as we work today. It's work more than words. I invite anyone who's not here working on the ground in the trenches, but who are calling shots from the booth, if you will, to come out in the streets and work with people and see the impact that people are having, see the enthusiasm that we're getting from actually people going to talk and working with them.
Kat,
and
do you agree
that the movement is not over by any stretch of the imagination?
Yeah, George, I definitely totally agree with what you said, that, you know, Occupy needs to, you know, watch out for being co-opted. I mean, it's normal and healthy to, you know, because you know not want to lose the leverage and momentum that they've gained,
right.
And I was just gonna kind of make a joke and say that maybe Occupy ought to get a couple of TSA agents, you know, and hire them to, like, you know, pat people down, you know, before they, you know, like, just kind of to, you know, to turn the tables a little bit, you know, just like so the other guy can see what it feels
yeah.
like.
You know, I'd like to just comment a little bit, George, get your thinking on this whole co-optation fear. I raised it a minute ago. Yes. You know, the last thing we need now is to paralyze this movement, to get paranoid, to get suspicious of each other, to, move forward in a way, fearful that somebody who has a different approach or a different idea is somehow your enemy. And that's a way to divide the movement, not unite it, in my opinion, having been around movements for a long time.
No question about it. Listen, when we were in Zuccotti Park, anyone that was in that park, when we defended the park from the police invasion, when we mobilized the two-month anniversary at Foley Square, anyone who was around recognizes that anyone who could have said those things about who wasn't welcome, about what wasn't appropriate, if that was brought to bear, we would have called... Organically, people would start calling that provocateurs, because what we knew is that everyone had a different reason why they came. Everyone had a different activation point. We saw people, old folk, young folk, black, brown, like Asian, white folk, wealthy, middle class, poor people, organizing, galvanizing in ways that they haven't done before. And so everyone had the right to be suspicious of the next person. I went to Zuccotti Park suspicious in the first place. What the heck is going on in my city? So that's fair.
Yeah,
that's
but at
okay.
the
that's
yeah, but you were open-minded enough,
of
George.
Of course.
It's about being flexibly cautious.
Yeah. It's about a movement. It's not about what one particular person thinks is the best thing, and that's what the movement taught us. We know that consensus around the issue is important, but we also know that autonomous individual actors with their own experiences are going to bring to bear their knowledge and their engagement.
So let me just ask you now, let's get off the platform of theory and analysis. Let's get into some practicality here. Your campaign is being launched. How can people who want to help you, George, do so? Is there a number to call? Is there a website to check out? Is there a way to get involved? If you who are listening support this man and his effort, his bold effort to run for office against a Democrat, by the way, and to try to offer an occupied view in the Congress, how can people find out more? How can they get involved?
Well, for folks that want to get involved with this direct action and want to help us push the Democratic Party forward and give them some backbone to be able to deliver on progress, measurable results, and folks can reach out to us on the website at www.bumrushthevote.net. You can find us on Twitter, the handle at bumrushthevote. You can find those two ways are the best ways to reach out to us. We're a grassroots effort. We're not taking any corporate donations. We're not taking any corporate PAC money. They say it costs $1.2 million to run a congressional race. We got on the primary ballot with three times as many signatures with just a little over $500 raised at that point. Getting money out of politics is important, but controlling politics without money is power. It's people power. This is the Bum Rush to Vote direct
action. So you're saying, let me get this straight, you're saying that if the Koch brothers themselves came to you, said, George, we like your spirit, we like your style, we want to actually encourage movements to the left of the Democratic Party, we want to give you a lot of money, you would say...
No, sir, thank you. I might not say sir and thank you, but...
what about as long as the money is going to be used for what you want it to be used
no,
for?
No. See, part of the issue is we've dealt with the apologist too long. We've dealt with folks in the Democratic Party who said, well, this is the context that we're working in, so you have to understand. And no, when we want to be serious about building a new model that empowers people, then we have to bite the bullet. We have to go through the tough times, but we will get there. We will not take corporate money. That is the bum rush creed. As we start rolling out candidates across the country and across other cities, that is what keeps us tethered to the movement. It keeps us honest, and it keeps us connected to the core power of what Occupy represent, that
okay.
people can once again take back our country.
The Koch brothers.
Vamanos, George, yes, okay. I'm really thrilled that you could make it, even if it's only on the phone. Hopefully we'll get to meet sometime in the future. Anyone interested in my take on all this, I have two books out, one blog-a-thon dealing with Occupy and a new book called Occupy, Dissecting Occupy Wall Street. That's my take on the basis of my own experience going back into the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and, you know, the anti-apartheid movement, et cetera, and so forth. So George Martinez, running for Congress, and very bold, very articulate, as you've heard. Thank you for joining us. Stay with us, because Leo Haviland, author of Words on the Street, Language and the American Dream on Wall Street, is coming next. Don't go away.
We know that your life is hard, so please put down your guard. We'll send you a gift to give you a lift, a shiny new credit card. Don't fret if your funds are low. You can use it wherever you go. Whenever you do, your debts will accrue and give us a happy glow.
It's so fantastic.
Fantastic.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also be of A. American Express and Visa Morgan Stanley.
Well, that's the In Debt We Trust anthem from my film In Debt We Trust, 2006, warning of the financial crisis. We made the film and we got basically told I was an alarmist. I was a doom and gloomer. I didn't know what I was talking about. You know, the economy had never been stronger. Then a year later, ba-boom. You know, there you had the Bear Stearns going down, and followed by Lehman, and followed by this, you know, incredible financial crisis, which is still continuing today in the New York Times. Paul Krugman is still characterizing this whole period as a depression, not a recession, and he's talking about the economic collapse here. Leo Haviland worked on the street, worked for a number of different firms over 30 years, Goldman Sachs, Sempra Energy Trading, and other institutions. He's a graduate of the University of Chicago and the Cornell Law School. As a Cornellian myself, I'm happy to welcome you here. This is one of these books that a publicist tells you about, and I was just, you know, I put it aside. It was too big to really kind of get into. And then as I began to read through it and to look at it, I find it a really brilliant analysis of the language of Wall Street, the culture of Wall Street, the way it impacts on the American dream or what's left of it. And I wanted to invite him on here because I think this is somebody who's spent obviously a long time working on this. The book is like how many pages, Leo?
About 600 pages.
It begins in part with a quote from the Grateful Dead song. You know, I've been gambling hereabouts for 10 good solid years. If I told you all that went down, it would burn off both your ears. So, Leo, meet Catherine in the studio. She's an occupier. She's occupied the studio. When I started the show, I can't get her out of here. She's occupied it, and I'm happy that she has. At any rate, so now we want to talk a little bit about Words on the Street. Tell us a little bit about you and how this whole project began to form in your mind. Obviously, it's a substantive work over many years.
Well, thank you, Danny and Catherine, for having me on your show. It's an honor to be here. The book started with curiosity about how Wall Street persuaded people using various colorful metaphors from games, love, war, religion, science, and the fine arts, as well as American dream and investment language, and also made me curious about why were there so many different points of view on Wall Street. And so with the goal of giving audiences a new way of looking at marketplaces, I started to type.
Well, not just type, but think. I mean, that's what I find interesting about this is, you know, there are a lot of people who know how to spew. You wind them up, just tune in on CNBC, you know, anytime, and you'll find instant experts on everything. Seconds after something happened, people have instant opinions, often wrong, but nevertheless, they sound so authoritative. And yet, what you're saying here is that the language of Wall Street actually is deeply rooted in American culture and different aspects of culture. They've shaped a narrative, a message, if you will, to take a gambling, you know, institution which is built around, in a way, greed and fiscal empowerment, wealth creation for a limited number of people, and turned it into an American institution, a global institution. Tell us about how this was done.
Yes, well, the Wall Street community, which is a diverse culture but still a shared culture, has associated itself with the American dream values of money, wealth, prosperity. They've used the language of investment as one tool, but also they've used the language of rationality and goodness, which tie into a long-standing American dream tradition going all the way back to the Puritans.
Is this why, you know, the president, the commander-in-chief, the head honcho, the capitan of Goldman Sachs said he's doing God's work? I mean, basically anointing Goldman Sachs with a divine mission.
The chairman of Goldman later said he was joking, and if he said he was joking, I find that comment troubling. If he was serious or partly serious, it does fit the tradition of working in a calling for the benefit of others. So it's a very American statement on its face.
Well, let's get into that a little bit, you know, because, you know, in principle, the idea if I have a dollar and I invest it with you and suddenly it becomes $5, you know, that is the American way, if you will, you know, a way to leverage your money and put it into something that will lead to more money. But this is not exactly what's happening there. It seems like there's a layer of incredible manipulation, both on the language side and on the actual operational side.
On the language side, as you know from your in-depth experience in political movements and in the economic community, Danny, the persons who control and influence the language have substantial power and influence over how other people think and how other people act. So Wall Street's collective effort to control or influence language and outlooks is extremely important.
So, you know, I'm a media person, and, you know, a media spin is something which is well honed, well learned, well used, directed often by PR firms and the like to hit certain message points. You know, Bill Clinton went off message earlier in the week when he supported the Bush tax cuts, only to go on a new message and say he made a mistake. He's sorry. That's not what he really meant to be saying. So there is a way in which there's a line, a political line that people tend to take, and there's a set of values they tend to promote, even when they don't necessarily believe in them. I mean, one of the things I found in this film that was being made, you know, about In Debt We Trust, was about the subprime mortgages. Subprime mortgages started out as a sort of reform. The idea was to give people who couldn't qualify for regular mortgages a sort of an opportunity. They would pay a little bit more, but yet they could enjoy the wonders of home ownership in America. Even as the people who basically took their money knew from an analysis of their, you know, of their portfolio and what money they had, was that they were going to, you know, default on those loans. They were going to have to be foreclosed upon. So it was a callous, cynical, but nevertheless manipulative use of language to talk about the importance of home ownership with one breath and knowing, fair, you know, in very, very well, you know, that these people would not be in their homes long.
You make excellent points, Danny. An oil trader once said to me, "Leo, all I ever asked for was an unfair advantage." Wall Street does do things to help those in Main Street in terms of giving them places to earn returns. And Wall Street has long helped people to raise capital and sovereigns to raise capital. However, at times in the pendulum of activity by Wall Street, as well as others, there can be perhaps too much love of money, too much self-dealing, too much self-interest, so that the actions of many become predatory rather than helpful. And perhaps one word that has come into parlance in recent use is a sign of that, and that's the term human capital. When I grew up, thinking of humans as capital just didn't occur. Now it's part of Wall Street parlance.
Well, you know, I mean, there's this phrase, and I want to get your take on this too, Catherine, you know, which is used regularly and routinely, the notion of the bottom line. You know, everything is about the bottom line. Now, whose bottom line, and where did that come from?
I think it must have been some very clever publicist or accountant.
You know, the bottom line being, of course, you know, you end up with more money than, you know, I mean, I worked at ABC News and I wrote a book called, I'm going to get to you in a second, Cam, just thought of the story. You know, the more you watch, the less you know. And I talked about ABC. ABC was you know, selling itself, was selling itself for $11 billion. 3 years later, it sold itself for $19 billion. Obviously, it didn't increase in value so much. And they spoke to the head, you know, of ABC that made all this money. He says, well, you know, we ended up, you know, it was all about how much money we ended up with. You know, it wasn't like it had nothing to do with value necessarily, underlying value or meaning. It had to do with how much they could extract from the marketplace, Catherine.
I just was going to say that, I mean, the evidence just pretty much speaks for itself. You know, the reality of what's happened and the fact that, you know, so many people did get, you know, robbed and really end up with the short end of the stick. And you know, Wall Street and the bankers really kind of ended up, you know, making out. So, I mean, like, that reality speaks for itself. So, I mean, you know, I mean, Wall Street can be saying all they want that, like, oh, you know, they really want to help the little guy. But, I mean, obviously, they really don't, you know. Yeah. And the you know, the words, you know, like, that's just it. There's a complete disequilibrium between the words and the evidence. And so what are you going to listen to, the words, or are you going to look at the facts? I mean.
Well, it's important to look at the facts, and the ones that you know of are particularly telling, but also it's telling that of Wall Street's influence and the banking influence is they manage to, through the political process, get billions and billions and billions of aid from politicians, which if they didn't have significant control over or influence on, at least, the processes and the politicians and the vocabulary, they wouldn't have been able to accomplish it.
So they really are doing it for, like, you know, it's all the shareholders. It's the people behind the scenes pulling the strings, and they put it under the guise of, you know, helping the little guy, but they really need the little guy to pull these scams off on so that, you know, the other people are profiting.
Well, without Main Street, there wouldn't be Wall Street.
Exactly.
You know, the concept that I grew up with was, you know, trickle down. You know, somehow, you know, if a group of people made a lot of money, other money would trickle down to the masses, to the working people, and all the rest of it. And, of course, you know, people, you know, work and sweat their whole lives and have pensions in some cases, which often they don't manage and don't control. They're managed by big public companies who then use the money to invest in various things like media companies and the like. And, you know, so you have a situation where the money of ordinary people is financing the lifestyle of a very wealthy people. And we have this growth in economic inequality, the likes of which I don't think we've seen since the Middle Ages, basically, you know, in the United States and in other parts of the world. So, you know, the system seems so complicated, seems so complex, you know, and people feel like you can't change it, but it seems like it can't function and be in a stable way because it's always, you know, itself volatile because of all the people who are, you know, squeezing each other and trying to make money off of each other.
The wealth stratification in this country now, and as well as in many other Western countries, does recall that of the Gilded Age of 100, 120 years ago. And I'm sure that the persons making money, massive amounts of money back then, had excellent reasons or justifications for their entitlement to that. What's particularly worrisome this day and age beyond the wealth stratification is the political divisiveness, which is seems to be growing in the States and in Europe, where with various serious issues, left, right, center are finding it difficult to agree, and the middle class in particular is being badly squeezed.
I mean, I just came back from, you know, the weekend down in Chantilly, Virginia, where the, you know, not so well-known, not so mainstream media publicized Bilderberg group met at this location that they had met in once before, maybe 4 years ago. And it was even found out the people that worked in the hotel were speaking out how, like, completely just, like, rude, you know, the limo drivers were not allowed to look at them, not allowed to even, you know, exchange with them. The people working in the hotel, you know, you're not allowed to talk to them, you know, and they were calling the protesters, you know, just, you know, like, we're just, you know, like, lower than low. I mean, and it's, there it is. I mean, the evidence is right there in your face. I mean, these people are meeting in secret. There's no mainstream media there. You know, of course there's cops kind of protecting them. And I mean, so what does that say? It's right there, you know. Doesn't take a rocket scientist.
Well, you know, this elite, has many different meetings like this, many different formats like this to exchange with each other, to exclude the public itself. The Marriott hotels where it all took place. Marriott is a company, by the way, that has given a lot of money to the Romney campaign, that Romney was actually part of it. It's a Republican company going back many years, you know, supporting Nixon, the Marriotts, and all the rest of it. So it's not surprising that that's the location, and these meetings have taken place routinely, but it is true, and I think your point is well made, Catherine, that the mainstream media doesn't take it seriously, doesn't cover it, doesn't question it, and as a consequence, most people don't really know about it, whether or not it's the New World Order, or whether or not it's, you know, the conspiracy that we should be afraid of. I don't know about that, but I do know that when an event like this attracts as many powerful people as this attracted, it should be covered by our media. And the fact that it isn't is another reason that we have to be really concerned about the demise of democracy, because our media is supposedly the check on authoritarianism of various kinds. Constitutionally, it has a protection, the First Amendment, because the founders believed somehow, you know, that the media would be a check on abuse. But when the media becomes part of the abuse, we have to worry about that. Now, in terms of this book, you know, it's not, you do a very good job intellectually and analytically talking about the American dream language and all the rest of it, but you also worked in this environment. What was that like for you as somebody who, you know, had critical thoughts and had questions about what was going on? What was it like to be at Goldman Sachs, for example?
You got to see the sharp edge of the American dream in action, where the making of money was the primary value. So that was a very interesting experience. And one fortunate aspect of my working there and elsewhere on Wall Street is it gave me an opportunity to visit with a lot of different people around America and around the world and to explore their points of view on making money and how they looked at the world in general.
Would you call it, like, maybe a mob mentality? I mean, how much money do you need? Like, where does it end? Like, where do you draw the line? Because obviously they did cross a line. in their pursuit of this American dream at the expense of the American dreams of about 90% of the population.
It the American scheme. Leo, what was your
American scheme.
What's the takeout here? You know that you know of your being in there. You know, yes, you met all these people and they shared your. You know, but when you raise questions with them, did you find an environment of self-doubt, an environment of people who looked the other way when, you know, ethical issues were raised? How does that culture operate this way? I mean, I was at a dinner the other night, kind of a big NGO, and I was sitting next to a woman. I thought, well, what do you do? She said, I work for J.P. Morgan, okay? Mm-hmm. And her husband is a doctor. And she was telling me, you know, that her husband would go down to Occupy and provide medical services to the people down there. And she said that some of the people from Occupy came over to her office and that they tried to help them. You know, what is your take on this? I mean, we live in a culture of so many contradictions.
The leaders in many institutions will ask in regard to their dealings with others, the key question, is it legal? The questions are, of course, important, but usually if one asks, is it right, that question doesn't really get raised all that often. It's, is it legal? And that attitude is prevalent in Wall Street as well as many other areas.
You know, but the question of legality, of course, is subject to the fact that a lot of the Wall Street firms have invested a lot of money in politics, campaign contributions, lobbying, and the like, to ensure that laws they didn't like were muted, and we're still having this battle now about the implementation of the Dodd-Frank financial reforms, you know, where Wall Street has, you know, 28 lobbyists for every member of Congress trying to ensure that these rules and regulations will not impose too much of a burden on them.
And that's an example of their effort to control the words. So if they can influence it and guide it, that is going to influence their success in the profession they're in.
It's one reason why I really like Gerald Celente a lot, because he makes it a point to call something what it is, which, you know, to me is one of the key things that you have to do, is just name something what it is, because that's how, you know, people, the fast talk, you know, the complicated language, that's how they get over, is, you know, just fast talking. And, you know, they want to confuse people by, you know, making it intimidating, well, and that's how they get over.
I mean, I wanted to comment on Wisconsin and events that happened in Wisconsin. Of course, a lot more money was spent by the people supporting Scott Walker and, you know, fighting against the recall successfully in Wisconsin. But there was a lot of, you know, ways in which the Democrats also played to this game. They weren't really talking about labor rights. They were talking about some corrupt politicians in the Walker administration. They weren't really presenting a message that could unite, you know, the people against, you know, what Walker represents, which is not just Walker, of course, but all of these interests that invested so heavily in his campaign. And as a consequence, the battle narrowed, you know, like we're for collective bargaining rights for municipal unions, when really that wasn't the only issue there. And yet the newspapers and the media narrowed the range of permissible debate and discussion so that we ended up not talking about what was really going on. Mm. And the analysis, therefore, you know, of why the Republicans won, you know, it tends to be very, mechanistic, you know, it's like one thing, it's money, or it's, you know, the people felt that, you know, you shouldn't recall a governor just on the grounds of his having ideas that are different than yours, et cetera, and so forth. They managed to spin the issues in a way to make them really incomprehensible to the people who were out there at the beginning fighting against the Walker administration. And this is the danger that we have in our political system, the way in which, you know, he who controls the language, if you will, controls the media, has you know, basically help shape what we talk about, not just whether you're, you know, on one side or the other. I just received a report this morning that the Republicans have managed to kill a regulation in the FCC that requires the disclosure of how much money is being spent by various people on campaign advertising on television. Now, you know, not only do we have super PACs where we don't know who the donors are, but now there'll be TV ads and we won't know who the donors are either. So, you know, this is, you know, the issues that we need to deal with. Leo, thank you so much. We could go on a lot longer. I really want to recommend this book, Words on the Street, Language and the American Dream on Wall Street by Leo Haviland. It's published by a company called Dog Ear Publishing. It's a really serious, substantive, provocative, and interesting a way of looking at what's going on Wall Street that goes deeper than just like who's ahead and who's behind, what the figures are. And thank you for the effort that you made. I wanted to have you on to tell you that personally. I appreciate it. I just have a few announcements now because I'm going to be leaving. And we're going to be recording a little show after this to be able to play in a week or more, a week or two. But I'll be on my way to South Africa at the end of next week. I'm working alongside the movie Long Walk to Freedom about Nelson Mandela's life, his autobiography. We're making a documentary about it. I've been invited to South Africa. I'm being brought down there to work on it. So I'm really happy. This is will be my seventh documentary about Mandela. And, you know, it's one of the great men of our times. And I've been really honored to be in his presence. So I will be here. We will be repeating some of our shows as well as hearing this broadcast and where I'm going to talk about my new books and my ideas. I don't have any guests, but Catherine will be here, provoking me to tell the truth. And we'll be doing that a little bit more. So you can tune in to me every day on newsdissector.net. That's our website. I also edit mediachannel1.org, which is a network about media coverage that we've been doing for quite a number of years at Global Vision, my company, now marking its 25th anniversary. My new book is Blogathon and Occupy, Dissecting Occupy Wall Street from Cosimo Books. Please take a look at them if you will. You can read about my book, my film, Plunder the Crime of Our Time at plunderthecrimeofourtime.com. And we're going to go out with the song Plunder. And it has this song, Leo, you'll be happy to know, the actual voice of none other than Bernie Madoff. And Bernie Madoff in the judge, you know, talking to the judge, basically cops to what's happening. So we're going to go out with that. Incidentally, I just saw an item in the New York Times where the lawyers are making more money than Bernie Madoff's victims.
Danny, thank you for having me on.
I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got dulled. When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off, workers paid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets, empty.